Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries, daily over the internet and radio. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Tell Them a Story, right after this. You know, once in a while, we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider, an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft back in 1880. And someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. And Swinton just outraged all of his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions. And if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with. And others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. Now, if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We, he said, are intellectual prostitutes. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this Global 2000 program and the New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers, Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order, this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto our archives page, and you can download that free General Law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, last time we were talking about employers and employment and the important things that you do when you're dealing with customers as a contractor or you're dealing with an employer to see how you can get the maximum mileage from your efforts. Well, there's another group of people that we have to do business with. Not only do we have to interact with employers and customers, but we have to interact with government bureaucrats, the bureaucracy, the police powers of the state. And if you think your boss is a tough guy to get along with, wait until you try to deal with the fire inspector, or you're trying to deal with the building inspector, or some other government agent or agency that you're trying to get some permit or some permission so that you can go to work. So there's a number of these stories that are out here in front of us, and I'm not sure that everybody hears these stories. We typically hear of some kind of a hard luck story where the government has done something really nasty to somebody and put them in jail or something on that order, but once in a while, we'll hear a story of beating City Hall. You ever heard that story? You know, you can't beat City Hall. Well, that's not exactly correct. And the reason for that is that City Hall and the bureaucracy, the bureaucrats that run it, have a game plan. They have a book that they follow, their policy manual. And all they know is what's in the policy manual. And so they follow that policy manual. And if you knew what was in the policy manual, then you'd know better how to deal with the bureaucracy. So there's a story that deals with this thing of the bureaucracy and the policy manual, and it's kind of a cute little story. And like the story of the goose that lays the golden egg that we talked about yesterday, well, this is the story of the bureaucracy, the insurance company, the form, the policy manual. Listen to this. It starts off, "I am writing in response to your request for additional information in block number 3 of the accident reporting form. Now, I put trying to do the job alone as the cause of my accident, and you said in your letter that I should explain more fully, and I trust that the following details will be sufficient. I am a bricklayer by trade, and on the date of the accident, I was working alone on the roof of a new 6-story building. When I completed my work, I discovered that I had about 500 pounds of brick left over. So rather than carry the bricks down by hand, I decided to lower them in a barrel by using a pulley at the sixth floor. Securing the rope at ground level, I went up to the roof, and I swung the barrel out and loaded the bricks into it. Then I went back down to the ground and I untied the rope, holding it tightly to ensure a slow descent of the 500 pounds of brick. Now you will note in block number 11 of the accident report that I weigh 135 pounds. Now due to my surprise of being jerked off the ground so suddenly, I lost my presence of mind and I forgot to let go of the rope. And needless to say, I proceeded at a rapid rate up the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming down, and this explains the fractured skull and the broken collarbone. Slowed only slightly, I continued my rapid ascent up the side of the building, not stopping until my fingers of my right hand were two knuckles deep into the pulley. Fortunately, by this time, I had regained my presence of mind, and I was able to hold tightly to the rope in spite of my pain. At approximately the same time, however, the barrel of bricks hit the ground, and the bottom fell out of the barrel. Now, devoid of the weight of the bricks in the barrel now weighs approximately 50 pounds. I refer you again to my weight in block number 11. Now, as you might imagine, I began a rapid descent down the side of the building. And again, in the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming up. And this accounts for the two fractured ankles and the lacerations of my legs and lower body. The encounter with the barrel slowed me enough to lessen my injuries when I fell onto the pile of bricks. And fortunately, only three vertebrae were cracked. Now, I am sorry to report, however, that as I lay there on the bricks, in pain, unable to stand, and watching the empty barrel six stories above me, I again lost my presence of mind and I let go of the rope. Now, the empty barrel, weighing 50 pounds, more than the rope, it came back down on me and broke both of my legs. Now, I hope I have furnished the information that you require as to how this accident occurred. Now, you know, we sit here and we listen to a little story like that and we laugh and we kind of chuckle and we say, oh my God, Daddy is really stupid. And that's what makes it so funny. The stupidity of it makes it really hilarious, doesn't it? Now, insurance even by itself should be hilarious. It isn't. It's a very serious business. And the people who run and operate these insurance businesses are paid professional thieves. And they use these kinds of tactics. Let me describe one for you here. And one of the tactics that I learned as an insurance adjuster, this guy, you know, this is a typical example of a guy putting in a claim. And so we owe this guy the money because he's been injured on the job. So it's a workman's compensation claim, and so we're going to pay it. But we have a thing called the average daily balance. And so the insurance company has millions of dollars that they have in an impound account, and it draws a certain amount of interest. Now, let's suppose, in the sake of this discussion here, these bodily injuries total $20,000. We owe this guy the $20,000, and we should cut him a check for $20,000 and pay him today. But because we have this $20,000 in the bank in an impound account drawing interest on a daily basis, if we pay the guy next month, we would collect that interest for 30 days. Now, to show you how this is calculated out, if the insurance company has $1 million in the bank, I'll plug $1 million into my Sharp EL1197G here, and let's just suppose that they've got times 0.05% interest, they're making $50,000 a year off of that impound account, which the law requires that they maintain to pay off these claims. Now, they get paid daily. See, for keeping that kind of money in the bank, the insurance company makes a deal with the bank, and they say the law requires that we keep 20% of our claims potential liabilities in the bank. So if you want us to keep this in your bank, then you pay us our interest daily. And if you don't pay us this interest daily, then we'll put it in somebody else's bank. So the bank, wanting the $1 million deposit, which is a whole lot cheaper for them to deal with than to deal with 1,000 people with $1,000. They don't have 1,000 accounts, just have one account with $1 million on it. All right, so now the bank says, okay, well, we're going to pay you $50,000 a year, which is the market rate, and we're going to pay you this interest daily. So now we have to divide that by 360 days. It ain't 365, it's 360. And they're going to pay $138.88 a day on that account. Now, this insurance company has lots of claims coming in every day, lots of claims coming in. And the insurance agents, the claims managers, the claims adjusters are all instructed, delay the payment of the claim as long as possible. We're going to pay you. But if I pay you today, we lose $138.88. If I cut the check tomorrow, I make $138.88 today. That pays my salary at your expense. Now, what if I could stall you off for a week? Okay, so let's go times 7. That's $972.22. The insurance company is going to make $972 if I write the check next Monday instead of today. See how that works? Hey, it gets better than that. Let's suppose that I write you a letter and I say, we need more information. We don't have enough information in your claim. So we want you to write us a letter and give us more information. And so this funny story I just wrote you, the bricklayer story, is a classic example of how the insurance company screws you. And so it's going to take you now a week. It took me a week to write you the letter and say, gee, we're not going to send your check till you send us some information. It takes you a week to send me the information, and I'm going to send this information into the company, and then the company's going to send me a letter back, and they're going to see if there's something in this letter that we still need clarification on. And so I write you another letter, and then, you know, you write me a letter, and you give me a response, and you fill this in. You people out there trying to get paid, you know, for your hospital bills, and you wonder why it takes months and months for the insurance company to pay off and why they refuse and then finally have to sue them. Listen. Every day that goes by, we're making $138 a day off your money. I mean, it's like you people dropping $1 million into my bank account. It's your money, but I'm collecting the interest on it. All right, so you get 972.22 times 4.3 weeks in a month. That's $4,180 a month. So if I can stall you off, partner, and if all the other claims adjusters in the system can stall off their claims for 30 days, the insurance company makes $4,180. Not just off of your account, but off of all of these collective accounts which are sitting in this account. And that's what the insurance industry is all about. They're playing just like the croupier on a crap table. Some bets we win, some bets we lose, but on average, we collect a certain rate or percentage. And one of the rates or percentages that we collect on is the average daily balance. And that's the moral of the story of the bricklayer story. It's to explain to you a real-life circumstance that occurs in the real world. It applies to more than just insurance companies and average daily balances, but just like the story of the goose that lays the golden egg, it applies to more than just agriculture or the fruit trees or the apple trees in the Wenatchee Valley. But that's an example of an application of a story in real life operation. Now, one time many years ago, I was sitting in the Winchell Donut House. You know, contractors meet every morning at Winchell's for donuts and coffee. That's what we live on, donuts, coffee, and cigarettes. And we get our crews in there, and we all come in. We start at 6 in the morning. You know, contractors get up early in the morning. We start our day about 5, and we get down to Winchell's about 6, and we're eating coffee and donuts, and we're looking over our clipboards, and we're looking at our new orders and old orders. And our employees, you know, our workmen come in, and they have coffee and donuts and cigarette. And I say, David, I want you to take these three jobs, and I want you to take Bob with you, and I want you to go out to this job. Here's what I want you to do. All right, Larry, you and Sam, I want you to take pick up number 2. Oh, that one's broke. Oh, damn, it's in the shop. Oh, okay, well, then you'll have to take my pickup. Don't worry about me. I'll take a cab back to the office. You know, you're scoping everything out. Now, contractors are a strange breed. They're entrepreneurs. They're businessmen, and they have to make a profit. That's the reason they're in business, but there's a break-even point here. You know, when you got 14 men, 7 pickups, you have overhead, gasoline, costs of keeping the pickups up, and this payroll, this god-awful, incessant payroll that just keeps rolling up and rolling up. See, every hour that these guys are on the job, for you wage earners out there, let me show you how this compounds when you're an employer. See, you're making $10 an hour. Now, when you have 14 employees and they're all making $10 an hour, that's $140 an hour. If you have 10 men sitting around smoking cigarettes for 15 minutes, do you know how much that costs? Well, at $140 an hour, and we'll divide that, or we could just go by times 0.25, it cost me $35 to watch 14 men sitting in my office smoke cigarettes. Now, you got to ask yourself, employees, do you really, honest to God, believe that your boss, your employer, wants to spend $35 watching all you guys sitting around here in the union hall smoking cigarettes or sitting around the office or the shop? No, I'm telling you from personal experience, I don't want to watch that. So I need to get these guys out on the road. I need to get them out on the job, getting the customers paying for at least their travel time, nothing else, so that I can meet this payroll on Friday, which is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, let's see what this is, $140 an hour. You have 14 guys working at $140 an hour. Times 8 hours, it costs me $1,120 a day. Times 5 days, cost me $5,600 a week. And that doesn't count the employment taxes, you know, Social Security and unemployment and the rest. And that costs me times 0.17%. Now that cost me $1,000, $952. So I get a $5,600 payroll and I get $1,000 worth of payroll taxes. And that's accumulating every week, that's $6,600 a week, whether you guys do anything intelligent or not. So I have to collect $6,600 a week just to meet the payroll. Not to talk about PG&E and the rest of the guys out here that want to get paid also. So if you're wondering why your boss, you know, or your employer or somebody is kind of cranky in the morning, that's why. It's that payroll. That's that payroll. That's what makes all employers cranky. Well, after I got my crew sent out, Stan Nielsen and I are in here, and we're sucking on our coffee. And I was lamenting to him. I said, I just did a house out here on 23rd Avenue, and the inspector came out here, and he condemned the plumbing in it, and I got to replumb it. And he said, well, why did he condemn the plumbing? So I said, well, here's what I did. I've been doing these FHA 235 job program jobs for so long now. And when I saw this house on 23rd Avenue, I put two guys to work on it, and we turned out this house perfectly. Now, the way this works for you lay people out there, the government wants to rehabilitate a certain neighborhood in a city, and we happen to be working out in the avenues in East Oakland. And these houses out here are vacant, and they've been beat up, and you know, they're below current standards. And so the federal government comes up through HUD, and your taxpayer dollars are at work here. So, you know, thank God for you taxpayers. And they're going to rehabilitate this neighborhood. You know, they're going to bring it up to standard. So the city comes in, condemns all these houses, or they tell the owners of these slum properties out here, you got to bring them up to code or we're going to take them away from you. So I bought this house out here on 23rd, and I think I paid, if I remember right, $8,500. Now, this house doesn't have a CO. It's been pulled, and this house has to be fixed. And, you know, there's minimum standards. For instance, here's a standard. In the old days, they used to bring the water service from the meter into the house in a half-inch pipe. Okay, well, over the years, we figured out that half-inch galvanized pipe plugs up over time. So they come up with a new standard and say, now you got to have 3/4 inch. And today it's 1 inch. Now, plastic pipe's a lot better than the old galvanized pipe because that galvanized used to rust, and over time it developed corrosion in it. And so this is a reasonable rule. I'm not arguing here about the rules and the bureaucracy. I'm just pointing out that that's what has to be done. So I got to dig up, or I have to just dig a new line and put in a 3/4 or 1 inch line into the house. And I did that. And all the broken windows have to be fixed. And so I fixed the broken windows. And the sash cords have to be fixed. And I replaced all the sash cords. And the house has to be painted, and I painted it. And then we look at the roof, and if it's bad, it's got to be replaced, and you know, so on. And so I went through this house like a dose of salts. Now, I'm a professional. I know what the building codes are. I know what has to be done. And I estimated that cost when I bought the house. And there's no problems here. Now, this house has to be inspected by the building inspector, plumbing inspector, and the electrical inspector. When I get these three inspectors out here and they clear it, they will give me what's known as a certificate of occupancy. With a certificate of occupancy, I now call the HUD inspector, who comes over from San Francisco, and he goes through the house, he inspects it to see if it meets the HUD standards, because they're the guys that are going to guarantee the loan on it when the bank makes the loan for the new owner of the house when we sell it. Now, these houses are turnkey houses. They're old houses that have been completely remodeled, refurbished, painted. Everything is right up to code. I mean, this thing is just like, you know, the cat's meow. And they sell like hotcakes. And that's because the government is backing this thing. You know, I mean, tenants there, I mean, owners, new owners can come in here, you know, with 5% down or nothing down. And God love you taxpayers out there for doing this. Makes money for contractors and for construction workers, and it's good for buyers, and just a neat deal all the way around. Now, the problem is it takes about 6 weeks to get this to get this HUD inspector out here to inspect the house. If this house sits here for 6 weeks, you've got vandals in the neighborhood that are going to be breaking the windows and coming over here and vandalizing the house and spraying graffiti on it, and then all that's got to be fixed again. So from the contractor's point of view, he wants to get this house inspected just as rapidly as is possible. So knowing that it takes about 4 to 6 weeks to get the inspector from San Francisco across the Bay Bridge to inspect this house, why does it take 6 weeks? God only knows. I haven't got a clue. Maybe they've got so damn many houses, you know, they need to hire some more inspectors. But that was my experience. It takes about 6 weeks. So from the time I get the certificate of occupancy, which, by the way, the HUD inspector, first thing he wants to see is the CO. So you would normally finish the house, get the CO, and then call the inspector, which will be out the next 4 to 6 weeks. Now, if you're crafty, like I am, crafty, while you're doing the work, you estimate in the next 4 to 6 weeks, I am going to finish this house. So 4 weeks ahead of schedule, you call the inspector out. Now, you know he isn't going to be here for 4 weeks, right? Now, we finish the house, we get the CO, and the inspector now has been on call now for 4 weeks. So he's going to be here within the next 1 or 2 weeks, isn't he? That's the game plan. Now, the inspector comes out to this house right away. See, he comes out. This house has just been completed. I mean, my workman just left here yesterday. And when he comes in here, he puts on his white coveralls out of his car. He gets out of his car, he comes in the house, puts on his white coveralls, his white gloves, and he goes to work. And when he goes through this house, it is absolutely perfect. He cannot find a single thing in this house that is out of place or that does not meet code. Furthermore, it's got the CO. So he goes down under the house where all the black widow spiders and brown recluse spiders are, and he searches around and looks at the plumbing until he gets to a point where he can find something wrong. And he writes that up and says, replace it. He comes back out from under the house. He says, well, this is pretty good. You did a good job on the house, but I find a few little things over here that need to be repaired. So here's my list. And go replace this and then call me back. Now, I can repair what's under the house in a day or two, and then I've got to wait 6 weeks to get this guy back again. In that 6 weeks, there's going to be some vandalism done. You see what our dilemma is here? I mean, as a businessman, you see my point? I need to get this show on the road. And every time the vandals come in here, that's, you know, hundreds of dollars of new expense that go into this project over here. And if these vandals have caused this damage before I can get it fixed, before the inspector comes by, he might take another 6 weeks. You know, this is the bureaucracy. This is what you're dealing with. This is why, all you guys out there, if you're wondering why your boss is so cranky and so grumpy, this is what this guy has to deal with every day. Every day. Not, he doesn't just deal with you employees every day. That's the easy part of the job. It's dealing with government, dealing with bankers, dealing with insurance brokers and real estate salesmen, all the rest of these guys, that he has to deal with in order to sell the product so that he gets the money to pay your payroll. That's what he's up against every week, is that payroll. It's the payroll blues. All right, so I'm in here talking to Stan, and you know what he said to me? He said, "You blame," and this plumbing job under the house can cost me about $1,000 to fix. And ordinarily, see, there was nothing wrong under the house. It's all passable. It's old, but it doesn't need to be replaced unless the inspector says replace it. And if he says replace it, then you got to do that. Now, I imagine some of the guys probably bribe these inspectors. See, I never did bribe the guys, and so therefore I probably was remiss in not paying my dues to the club. But this Nielsen, now he's an old guy. See, I'm a young contractor. I'm in my 30s, and old Stan, he's in his 60s. See, and old Stan was a paper hanger by trade. And then he said, "You fool! You blind! You nitwit!" So let me explain to you how this works. That inspector, when he comes over there, he has to report to his boss. And if he reports to his boss that he inspected a house and he didn't take any corrective action at all, his boss knows that he's not doing his job. The job of an inspector is to find fault. He has to find fault in the job. That's his job, is to find fault. And if he can't find any fault, he's going to go make some fault. That's what happened to you. He said, "Now here's what you do." He said, when you remodel the house, and then your workmen get through, you come into the workmen and you say, "Bob, do not paint all of the hall closet. Just paint half of it." And you say to Tom over there, Tom, "That sash cord that's broke over there, don't fix that one. Fix all the sash cords in the house, but don't fix that one. Leave it cut. Leave it broke." And then you go over to the next guy and say, "Hey, get this broken windows. Fix all the broken windows in the house, but leave one of them broken." Now when the inspector comes out, he finds a broken sash cord, an unpainted hall closet, and a broken window. He writes that up. He has found the fault that he has to find in his report. And I said, "But Stan, I'm trying to short circuit to get this guy in here one time instead of two." He says, George, you don't understand the bureaucracy. If those guys could come out one time and inspect, they would only need half as many inspectors. The reason that they need twice as many inspectors is because they come out twice. Wake up and smell the coffee, son. That's the bureaucracy. In order to keep the bureaucrats working, they have to make work, just like the union has to make work. And so the bureaucracy makes work under the police powers, and the union makes work under the contract. I mean, it's stupid, and it's insane, and it's time-consuming, it's costly, and it's inefficient, but that's the way the game is played. And I said, "Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Nielsen." And so after that, when I had a house to do, so that I didn't get dinged $1,000 on the plumbing under the house, and I'd go into the house, and if everything was fine, I'd take a ball-peen hammer, bust a window, take my knife, cut a sash cord, and then spray some graffiti on the inside. And then when the inspector got there, he would correct it, take his corrective action, tell me to fix it, and then I'd fix it, cost me $50, and then I'd wait 6 more weeks, he'd come back out, inspect the property, give me my okay, and I'd go ahead and sell it. Now, that's the lesson that you learn when you're dealing with the bureaucracy and you're dealing with insurance companies. That's a bureaucracy. And you're dealing with the union. I told you that story yesterday with the CO 4000 line international trucks with the broken cabs. Now, in order for us to function in the real world, dealing with bureaucrats and dealing with unions and so on, we have to learn to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And there's that story, boys and girls. Now, let me give you a reminder here at the halfway point that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, click on the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package for yourself right there in the privacy of your own home, and I don't have to put it in a plain brown envelope to hide it from everybody. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements and recommendations that we're giving out so freely here don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to endorse and recommend the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about the bureaucracy over here and how to deal with them. That's the bricklayer story. I told you that one, and I told you about Stan Nielsen here. There was another experience that I had years ago in an office that deals with the fire inspector. Now, fire inspectors are nice people, and I'm not down on any of you firemen or fire inspectors, etc. I'm just here to discuss the bureaucracy and the modality by which this bureaucracy operates. I'm sure that we all need fire inspectors, and I'm not sure that we need as many fire inspectors as we have, but maybe that's another argument for another time. But I rented a storefront. It was formerly an insurance office, and it was about 2,400 square feet. Pretty good size office. Now, at the time I was running my school in Boise, Idaho, we called it Barrister's Inn. Some of you old-timey listeners may remember Barrister's Inn. Now, I started Barrister's Inn down at the Mardi Gras, and then we moved from the Mardi Gras to this office building out 42nd Street on Chinden Boulevard, right across from the Outlaw. And on one side of me, there was a uniform store, and on the other side of me, there was a stereo store. So this is just a typical office building. There's nothing special about it. It's commercial. It was on Chinden Boulevard. So it was a commercial building. And Garden City, which is a separate little municipality next to Boise, little subdivision there, they had their own city council, their own mayor, their own water department and fire department and so on. They had zoning and planning. Now, in Garden City, I could not operate a business in a residential neighborhood. So if you were in a residential neighborhood and you were running a business, see, that would be a violation of zoning and planning. And we didn't want to break any laws. So now, I wanted to open my school and put it here, a private business, a private school, in this office building, but I didn't want commercial. See, I don't want to run a commercial business. This is a private school. This is private. And so in order to do that, I needed to have a home someplace. And I needed the space. I needed a pretty good size house, you know, or I needed a pretty good size office. And this office was renting for a relatively reasonable price, as I recall, about $1,200 a month. And I could have rented a house about that size for $400 a month. So commercial space, you know, on Chinden Boulevard across from the Outlaw in an office building cost you about three times as much as a house. But I knew that if I moved into a house that they'd be on me like flies on stink. And so I said, okay, I'm gonna rent an office. And so I did. Now, I did not want commercial in my office building. This is not a business open to the public. So if I'm not going to open a business to the public, under Wolf Company versus Industrial Court, and under Hale versus Hinkle, and Wickard versus Filburn, after all, we want to follow all the laws, I went down to the phone company and I said, turn on the telephone down here, and I want you to turn it on as a residence. And the lady looked this up and she says, oh no, that's not residential, that's commercial. And I said, no, it isn't. It's residential. And we had a little discussion and I said, now, it is true that it is zoned commercial, but Garden City has not zoned residential out of commercial, and I'm using it as my residence. And I don't want a commercial phone. I don't want a push-button phone. I want a rotary phone with a second number for my teenage daughter. So they argued about it a little bit, and I said, well, if we need to litigate, well, let's go litigate. And they checked out the zoning, and they said, well, they haven't zoned residential out, so I guess if you want to operate residential, I guess we'll sell you a residential service. Now, the difference between commercial service at $500 a month and residential service at $27 a month is pretty significant, isn't it? I mean, I could rent a house for $400. The telephone, commercial telephone is $500 a month, kids. So they put in my rotary phone with a second number for a teenage line. into my office on Chinon Boulevard at 42nd Street. They like that. Now, if I'm going to do that little trick, then I got to call the power company and the water company and the gas company and the garbage company and all these guys. I got to do the same thing, and I did. I went up there and said, now, none of those guys charged a difference. For instance, the garbage company, they didn't charge you twice or five times as much because it's commercial. The phone company, they gouge you. If you're commercial, they're going to stick it to you. Garbage company, they just charge you the same amount. Garbage can is a garbage can. Power company, same thing. Hey, if you got electricity coming in there, we charge by the kilowatt hour, and we don't care whether it's a house or an office. So I didn't have a problem until I got to the water company. Now, the water company was run by Garden City. So I went down to City Hall, and I said, hey, I got this water down here. And the girl told me, well, it's commercial, so you got to pay a $50 deposit. So if you're going to pay this $50 deposit on this water down here, then that's going to make this thing commercial, isn't it? So I got Garden City to put in. I told them, no, this is residential, and you haven't zoned residential out of commercial. And so I paid 3 months in advance, and I got in with my residential. Now, this isn't the story I want to tell you. I want to tell you about the fire inspector who's going to come in here a little later in the story here. But to give you the background now, I am licensed, bonded, and insured by the city of Garden City that it's residential. And the telephone company has put my telephone in, and that's residential. And so one day, my secretary, Peggy, comes into my office, and she says, the fire inspector is here. So I got up and I walked out to my living room, which was the foyer in the old office. Now, I had my Xerox machine out here in the foyer. You know, when you open up and you come into the office, there's this large public space, and then you go down a hall, and then there was four offices off the hall, a woman's restroom, a men's restroom, and then there was a kitchen in the back, and then there was a storeroom for office supplies. Now, this foyer out in the front was pretty good size, and I had a couch and chair, and I had law books, you know, lining the walls and so on. And so the fire inspector, now he says, when he comes in, he says, he handed me his card, and he said, you know, I'm Joe Simoli, and I'm here from the fire department to inspect your fire extinguishers and smoke detectors. And then I said to him, well, who told you that I have any fire extinguishers or smoke detectors for you to inspect? And he said, oh, you have to have fire extinguishers and smoke detectors because this is a commercial building. And I said, now, is the law for commercial buildings or is it for commercial businesses? And he didn't know. Now, that's a legal distinction, and it is kind of a technical point. But, you know, when you look up the law concerning a particular subject, you know, it could be trespassing or, you know, it could be speeding or driving on the right side of the road or something like that. What's the intent of the lawmaker? That's one of the rules of legal research. You know, what's the intent of the lawmaker in making this law? Is it to enforce this law on all commercial buildings that are in commercially zoned areas, or is it commercial businesses? He didn't know. I did. I looked it up. It was commercial business. So I told him, I said, I think, if I've got my ducks in a row here, that you're here to inspect for commercial business. Now, this is not a commercial business. You are standing in my living room. This is my residence. This is not a business. And he looked around the room. You know, he looked around and he said, well, what kind of a business is this? And I said to him, this is not a business. This is my home. This is a residence. And he said, but this is a commercial building. I said, that's right, and it's zoned commercial. But I am a residence in a commercial location. Now, you have zoned business out of residential, but you have not zoned residential out of business. And he said, well, that doesn't make any sense. Well, you have to pay $1,200 a month rent here. You're paying commercial rent here. He didn't know that it was $1,200, but he knew it was a commercial rent, and that commercial costs you a lot more than residential. And I said, that's true. That's true. I couldn't conduct a business out in a residential area, but I could conduct a residence here in the business area because you haven't zoned against it. And so you're standing in my living room. And I said, now, the next time you come back, would you please knock before you come in? Knock on the door before you come in. Now, you see, if you're in your home and I want to come and visit you, I come up to your door and I knock on the door, I ring the doorbell, and you come and answer the door. And if you want to invite me in, you do, and if you don't, you leave me standing on the porch, right? Okay. In a commercial building, you don't do that. In a commercial building, there's no doorbell. Nobody knocks before they come in. They just walk in the door. And we expect that. It's just a part of the code of conduct that we Americans use. In a commercial building, you just walk in. And, of course, he thought, you know, this is a commercial building. It's in a commercial neighborhood. And on one side of me, there's a uniform store. And on the other side, there's a stereo store. And across the street is the Outlaw restaurant. And on the other side of the uniform store, there was a motel. And it looked pretty commercial. And I don't deny it. It was commercial. But but I'm using it as a residence. And I've got a residence telephone. I've got a residence water. You know, everything in here is residence. And he was really miffed. This is what happens to a bureaucrat when he becomes frustrated, when he's faced with the law that he doesn't even know himself. Now, he's here to enforce the law, but he doesn't really know the law. He's a bureaucrat. He's following the policy. He doesn't know what the hell the law is. He's not hired. He's not a lawyer. He's never been to law school. He's not on the zoning and planning board. And he raised his voice and he said, now you better be in compliance with all the laws. And I said to him, what evidence do you have that I am out of compliance? And he said, well, you don't have fire extinguishers and smoke detectors. I said, excuse me, sir, but as I read the code, residences are not required to have fire extinguishers and smoke detectors. To which he replied, but this is a commercial building. I said, I don't deny it, but it's not a commercial business. And this regulation applies to commercial businesses. Go look it up. Oh, he was ticked off. Well, then, are you denying me access? I said, absolutely. You need a search warrant, son. And he stormed out of there, and then he was muttering under his breath. Now, I never saw the guy again. They used to come by, you know, in a commercial building, they come by every 6 months. And when I was running the Atlantis company, you know, the fire inspector came by about every 6 months, went through the building, inspected our fire extinguishers and our smoke detectors and our fire doors and ropes on the fire doors and everything else. But in the final analysis, as we look at this story over here, what's the moral to the story? Well, like the story of the goose that lays the golden eggs, if you're going to be a businessman, don't you think that you should know the laws that regulate your business? When the OSHA inspector comes in, shouldn't he know the OSHA inspector book or the OSHA handbook regulations? They don't. They know some of them. They don't know them all. But now, as a businessman, and I know that this is really going to miff you here, but I used to run a business and I didn't know the OSHA rules. So when the OSHA man would come in, he would lord it over me and he would say, well, the law requires this and the law requires that and the law requires something else and blah, blah, blah. And I was standing there with my mouth open like, you know, what am I going to say? Now, the difference in the case where the OSHA inspector came in, and I said, you need a search warrant here, son, you better go get one. And then I showed him the door. With the fire inspector, I didn't need to do that. And furthermore, that fire inspector, as I recall, was a big dude. He was about 6'16", as I recall, weighed about 300 pounds. And I didn't think I could pick him up and throw him out in the street. And so I just said yes, sir, no, sir, to him. But the OSHA guy was a littler guy, and I picked him up by the scruff of his neck and threw him out in the street. That's what caused all the trouble that I've had with government from that day to this. You know, I was getting along pretty well with the government until that OSHA guy came in, and I thought he needed a search warrant. Now, I'm really sorry. If you're that OSHA inspector that I threw out in the street, hey, I'm sorry, partner. You were right and I was wrong. You did not need a search warrant to come into my factory and conduct your investigation. Now, if you're the fire inspector, you did. Now, the difference between the OSHA inspector that I did not know the law and the fire inspector where I did, I took the time to look up the zoning and planning before I moved into the building to find out what the law required and what it didn't require. Now, the lesson I want to pass on to you is that in most cases, the bureaucrat that you're dealing with does not know the law. That's always been my experience. They do not know the law. They think they do. And when they come into your establishment, they lord it over you because you absolutely do not know what the law is. And so when he says, it's the law, it's the law, it's the law, it reminds me of the census taker. They always tell you this. It's evidently a part of their training. They will come in and they will say, I'm the census taker and I'm here to take the census. And when you decline and you say, I don't think I want to buy that, thank you very much, they say, yo, but it's the law. Now, when the census taker comes by, ask them, can you tell me what law that is? Now, get your pen and paper out here, boys and girls, because I'm going to tell you where the law is. I know where it's at. Because when the census taker comes and knocks on my door, I'm not going to give her any information. I'm not going to participate. It's not because I'm un-American or that I'm an anarchist. It's against the law to participate in a census. God Almighty himself told us not to do that. Of course, he told us not to take oaths, too, but we do every time we go into court. We raise our hands. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God? Oh, yeah, yeah, I do. You're told not to do that. People that take oaths and participate in the census. Now, I'm not going to do that. And you got your pen and paper out there? Okay, it's Title 13 of the U.S. Code. Title 13, Section 221 through 225. And the section you're looking for is 225D. All right, Title 13, Section 221 through 225. That's the census law. And then 225D. All right? For religious objectors. I'm a religious objector. I'm a Hebrew, and we don't practice these pagan Babylonian mystery religion practices of census and oaths. See how crazy this is? Christians do, and Hebrews don't. So if you're a Christian, shut up and give them the information. Now, if you're a Hebrew, you ought not to do that. So you tell them, well, in 225D, there's an exemption written in there, and I think that's what we want to litigate when we go to trial. And I think that that'll make a hell of a neat constitutional confrontation question. We can take that up to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, hey, listen, under Seeger versus U.S., you know, under religious free exercise pursuant to the First Amendment and the exemption written into 225D of Title 13, I think I'm exempt. And I think you'll have a good time doing it. Now, can you see the value of a story? Now, I've been telling you some stories here today, and these stories are educational. I'm not going to require that you memorize all of the words to these stories. But if you live to be 110, you're going to remember the fire inspector story, the bricklayer story, and the Stan Nielsen story. And what that does for you, it gives you a basis for when the census taker comes in and says it's the law, or the OSHA man comes in and says it's the law. Well, sometimes it is. And when the fire inspector said, hey, it's the law, commercial businesses have to have smoke detectors and fire extinguishers, he's telling you the truth. And so the trick to this little scenario is that you better not be in a commercial business. It better be a residence. And that's the value of learning how to do legal research so that you can look up the law and you can find out what the rules really require. Then when some bureaucrat comes in and says it's the law, you can cite the law to him and say, no, it isn't. And if you want to litigate, let's go to trial. That's the purpose for court, boys and girls. It's to go to trial. It's not to crucify you because you're ignorant. It's to take an issue and then litigate it and solve the problem. All right, with that story out of the way, I'm out of time, and I've got to give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.